Today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th canto, part 1, well, mine is part 1, 9th canto, chapter 2, and we're going to do, I would like to go to the chapter summary, just the first paragraph, and then I'm going to share a few verses of the story. So we're going to focus particularly on one pastime, which is in this chapter. Kind of a short chapter, but it's the one with a lot of names at the end. So the second half of the chapter has a lot of like lineages and so on. So we're going to be focusing on the first paragraph of the summary. This, let's see, would someone like to read this paragraph?
Eric.
Yeah. It's actually one line and then a paragraph.
Okay. The second chapter describes the dynasties of the sons of Manu, headed by Karusha. After Sudyumna accepted the order of Vanaprastha and departed for the forest, Vaivasvata Manu, being desirous of sons, worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead and consequently begot 10 sons like Maharaj Ikshvaku, all of whom were like their father. One of these sons, Prishadra, was engaged in the duty of protecting cows at night with a sword in his hand. Following the order of his spiritual master, he would stand in this way for the entire night. Once, in the darkness of night, a tiger seized a cow from the cowshed, and when Prishadra came to know this, he took a sword in his hand and followed the tiger. Unfortunately, when he finally approached the tiger, he could not distinguish between the cow and the tiger in the dark, and thus he killed the cow. Because of this, his spiritual master cursed him to take birth in a Shudra family. But Prishadra practiced mystic yoga, and in bhakti yoga, he worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then he voluntarily entered a blazing forest fire, thus relinquishing his material body and going back home, back to Godhead.
Mm. What a far-out story, right? Such amazing. I was going to mention one thing. You'll see it as you go through the 9th canto, that there are some pretty wild stories, some things that will really, a lot of stories about quote unquote injustices, like someone is cursed for something they didn't even really do by, you know, they kind of accidentally, or different sorts of things that might disturb your mind. Like, what, how is that possible? Like, how's that, you know, it's not fair. And one devotee described it to me. I remember when I was reading the 9th canto, I was having a lot of struggle somehow with the 9th canto. It was just a lot of things that, like, didn't sit right. And one devotee was explaining to me that the 9th canto, because it's right before the 10th, it's sort of like this last hall of purification before you get to Krishna's pastimes. Like, you're going to work through your stuff and purify it. And one of those, I don't know, is it the microphone okay? The speaker? Kind of okay? A little rattly. So one of the things, one of the lessons is from the 9th canto, one of the ways that one lesson we can take from it is the reminder that this material world is not a pleasant place and it's not our home. And there are, from the lowest regions to the highest regions in the material world, even the heavenly planets, there are injustices. There are things that happen between heavenly beings that are just outrageous, like someone being blamed for something that they didn't do. And all of those things will happen in the material world as long as we're in these material identities. And so the 9th canto is a great opportunity to kind of become a bit disillusioned by this material existence before, and wanting to, like, I want something beyond this material world. Even the heavenly planets are full of this strife and confusion, people getting mad and jealous. I want out of here. And then that's the 10th canto, which is, I want to learn how I can be part of Krishna's pastimes. So it's a great opportunity to face those things, and also to ask questions when we have confusions, ask questions from devotees. Okay, so in this story, I'm going to jump to, and you can just stay there for a minute. I'll tell you when to go. One thing that the summary was describing, that this son, his name was Prishadra, right? He was protecting cows at night. And so in one of the purports later, Prabhupada says that one who becomes Virasana takes the vow to stand all night with a sword to give protection to the cows. So that's the name of the person who does that, protector of cows. Virasana. Because Prishadra was engaged in this way, it's to be understood that he had no dynasty. So meaning that was he didn't have his own, he was just available to do that, right? We can further understand from this vow accepted by Prishadra how essential it is to protect the cows. Some son of a kshatriya would take this vow to protect the cows from ferocious animals, even at night. What then is to be said of sending cows to slaughterhouses? This is the most sinful activity in human society. So quite a sober purport. I was thinking about, we have those stories in contemporary or like in folklore of Western cultures as well of the, this is a common service that a lot of people do, like watching the sheep at night, taking care of the goats, or taking care of the cows, right? And I was thinking of that story of the boy who cried wolf, right? That was in the context of someone guarding the sheep, and then he was wanting to play with people. So he said, wolf, and he was just pretending, and then he knew that whole story. But so that's what he was doing. This kshatriya, very qualified person, because he was so qualified, he was engaged in this activity. Therefore, this activity, it's showing how important it is. Okay, so you can go to text 9 and just go to the texts. We're going to read a few here. Just the texts, like go back one. Yeah, text 9. Okay, so I'm going to read a few here. So although Prishadra had committed the sin unknowingly, his family priest, Vashishta, cursed him, saying, in your next life, you shall not be able to become a kshatriya. Instead, you shall take birth as a shudra because of killing the cow. Next, when the hero Prishadra was thus cursed by his spiritual master, he accepted the curse with folded hands. Then, having controlled his senses, he took the vow of brahmacharya, which is approved by all great sages. So we're seeing, the reason I'm reading this is because we're seeing what happens when a saintly person is unjustly treated. What is their behavior? How do they take it? What do they do with it? Thereafter, Prishadra gained relief from all responsibilities, became peaceful in mind, and established control over all his senses. Being unaffected by material conditions, being pleased with whatever was available by the grace of the Lord to maintain body and soul together, and being equal toward everyone, he gave full attention to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudev, who is the transcendental supersoul, free from material contamination. Thus, Prishadra, fully satisfied in pure knowledge, always keeping his mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, achieved pure devotional service to the Lord and began traveling all over the world without affection for material activities, as if he were deaf, dumb, and blind. Does this remind you of anyone else that we hear about in the scripture? Yeah, Jadavar, to anyone else? Yeah, Maharaj Rishabhdev. Just kind of acting aloof, acting as if you're not able to understand things or really see things, and just, becoming detached in that way.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So my question is, in the verse where the priest cursed him, it sounded more to me just like a description of what would happen because of karma. Like, it seems like the karmic rules are if you kill a cow, then you suffer some kind of consequence.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the priest really like cursing him, being like, okay, you wouldn't have this consequence, but now I'm forcing you to have this consequence? Or was he just being like, this is what happens when you kill a cow, man?
Yeah, it's a good question. And actually, in the purport that we're going to read, Prabhupada says that it was actually a mistake of the guru. The guru made a mistake. So it wasn't necessarily that he would have gotten that. It was a curse, like an actual active destiny put on him. I also had that question. I was thinking, well, you know, sometimes curses are almost prophetic. Like, this is what's going to happen to you because you behaved poorly. But I think the fact that the word curse is there means that there was some intentionality of Vasishtha to make that happen for him. Like, you're going to have that. Like, I'm upset with you, and that's your punishment, sort of. So then one more verse here. So with this attitude, Krishadra became a great saint. And when he entered the forest and saw a blazing forest fire, he took this opportunity to burn his body in the fire. Thus he achieved the transcendental spiritual world. And you can just stay there for a minute. So in this purport, Prabhupada says that those who are engaged in devotional service are unaffected by the results of their material activities. And that immediately after giving up his body in the fire, he reached the spiritual world. So what an amazing story, right? He took this opportunity of this curse, and instead of the curse happening, he actually totally skirted that whole situation. He didn't become a sudra. He actually left in this very life and went right back to Godhead from his behavior, which shows that bhakti or devotional service is more powerful than any kind of yogic curse or power of this material world, right? Just also nice. And the other thing I was thinking we can reflect on is when he got this curse, it's almost, he took it as almost like a death sentence in a way. Maybe, I don't know the time frame on this, but it almost sounds like he was like, okay, my next life is soon, so I'm going to wrap up this life. You know, it sounded like kind of a quick of like ending his duties, sort of wrapping up his material responsibilities and taking shelter in Krishna. So when that time comes for us, and sometimes it comes, hopefully for all of you, it'll be decades down the road. But sometimes we get a terminal illness or a diagnosis of some kind that we have to sit with, that we hear some news, right? It's not necessarily like the doctors cursing us, but they might be saying, hey, you have this thing that's going to happen. And how are you going to face that, right? Like that's something we can ask ourselves. And so we can take inspiration from what he did. And that, especially that verse 13, where he gave full attention to Krishna. And being pleased with whatever came to him organically, with whatever came to him naturally by the grace of the Lord. That means he was simple in his consciousness. Yeah, it just sounds so simple, right? It makes Krishna consciousness seem very simple. Just focus your mind on Krishna, one-pointed, and that's it. He left the whole world. It's interesting that samsaradava nalalida loka, right? That prayer, how this world is described as being like a forest fire. And that was how he ended his life, is there was a blazing forest fire. He walked through that, his body died and his soul moved on to the spiritual world. Something just very symbolic about that material world. Yes, it's flaming and it's burning, and it's at the end of the day, it's going to destroy our material body, but the soul is never touched by it. It's a very beautiful pastime. So let's do any questions or comments on that? Yes, go. Well, I thought about that, and there's some detail here that's missing. So I don't know, maybe someone else knows that. It's possible that he was in the area of a blazing forest fire and that he just didn't leave, you know? So I don't know whether, I'm not sure, but maybe Prabhupada Priya, if you have any thoughts on that.
I remember, I think I asked the same question when we were studying this.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that he had the intention to kill himself. He didn't like proactively do things in order to end his own life.
Yeah.
But yeah, he just didn't run away from it. It was like the situation came and he was just like, all right, here we go. Mm-hmm. And he just didn't avoid it.
Yeah. And that's a very personal, individual decision that you'll see that in the lives of devotees that have a terminal illness. And sometimes they'll choose to go down the route of the conventional, all the medical treatments. And other times they'll go, well, it's already stage whatever, and I'll just go with it until the end of my life. And either one, it's not like one's right, one's wrong. It's just that the path for that person, you know, whether they just move with what's coming or they you know, fight against it to try to heal the body, either way. But the focus is always Krishna. Yes, there was some other comments or hands up. Okay, Prabhupada, for you.
I like his pastime.
Because, you know, he gets cursed and it's unjust, but he's kind of, he outsmarts his guru. Like, because the guru's like, you're going to be a sudra next life. He's like, all right, then I won't have a next life. I won't take birth again because yeah. I don't want to be a sudra. And then he just, he avoids the curse altogether. He's not affected. He's not disturbed about it at all because he knows the means by which he can not be affected by it. And he just employs it. It was just so practical.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I like it too.
I have a follow-up to that.
Christina, you go.
What Prabhupada Priya said, it just, and what you said about like the purport says that the guru made a mistake, it's very comforting to me knowing that, like, you know, our mistakes can result in good things, right? Because like Krishna wanted Prasadra to come to him, right? Like that's kind of like that's what Krishna wants for all of us. So obviously Krishna was like, oh, how can I get this, you know, this very nice spirit soul to come back to me? And so the guru made that mistake, and then that result, like without the guru doing that, Prasadra probably would have stayed in the material world for more lifetimes. So it's kind of nice, like, oh, like even if I make a mistake, I don't have to feel so bad about it because it's part of Krishna's plan.
Mm.
Yeah. And usually like a theme, I mean, throughout the Bhagavatam, there's so many pastimes where somebody's getting cursed by a great personality. And we see that it's usually, although it comes off as a curse, it ends up being a blessing. So it seems that he had that faith that everything is happening by Krishna's will. Krishna knows my intentions, and this happened. I'm not going to blame him. I'm not going to, like, you know, cry that I was a victim of injustice. I'm just going to take this as an impetus to improve myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good lesson for us in our life when those things happen to trust that at the end of the day, those are going to be used. Krishna is going to turn those into blessings, those difficult moments. Or they are blessings. We just haven't seen it yet. We haven't noticed it yet. And I like what you said, Christina, too, that if we're sincere and we're like, we're not trying to make, you know, we're not trying to do things wrong. We're just being sincere souls. We're going to make mistakes, and hopefully Krishna can use those to advance other causes. Krishna can multitask. He can do things, you know, he can do all kinds of things. So, yeah. So let's do the text 9 and let's see what Prabhupada says about that mistake that the family priest made. Although Prishadra had committed the sin unknowingly, his family priest Vashishta cursed him, saying, "In your next life, you shall not be able to become a kshatriya. Instead, you shall take birth as a shudra because of killing the cow." So can you imagine that horror when he saw the daylight and he realized he had killed a cow by accident? Krishna. That's his whole, like, his whole duty was to protect the cows, and then he accidentally killed one. It must have been just the shock of that and then devastation for him. And then to get this curse, it's like added. It's like when you do something, you know, when you do something accidental and then you get punished on top of it, you know? Yeah.
Also amazing that he did not like.
So purport by Srila Prabhupada. It appears that Vashishta was not free from tamoguna, the mode of ignorance. As the family priest or spiritual master of Prishadra, Vashishta should have taken Prishadra's offense very lightly. But instead, Vashishta cursed him to become a shudra. It is the duty of a family priest not to curse a disciple, but to give him relief through the performance of some sort of atonement. Vashishta, however, did just the opposite. Therefore, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that he was Durmati. In other words, his intelligence was not very good. So he was not free from the mode of ignorance. Interesting, right? He was in this role of the family guru. So back then you kind of just followed the guru, family guru. But here, Prabhupada saying he wasn't free from the modes of material nature. And that the duty of a guru, it's so interesting. He should have taken his offense lightly. Isn't that so amazing to think? And this is Prabhupada writing. This shows Prabhupada's mood that the spiritual master is so encouraging and doesn't condemn. And Prabhupada many times, like a disciple would be like kind of a wayward soul going off and doing different things. Prabhupada always welcomed them back if they had that right attitude, and was never condemning, never cursing them. I'm going to curse you away for the next, he didn't have that attitude at all, Prabhupada. So he showed that the guru takes offenses lightly. Like a parent, like a good parent, right? It knows that the intention is there, and they try to fan the spark of the intention, and then do their best to correct. But they always give a alternative for misbehavior. Like, okay, you did this, and good corrective behavior is like, you did this, now you're going to have to do that to apologize. You're going to have to go rake that person's yard. So one point I wanted to mention here in terms of ignorance, Prabhupada specifically said he was covered by ignorance. And I was thinking about this, how Vasishtha, he was impacted by it. And ignorance, one other way to describe it is, what do you think of when I say ignorance? What comes to you? What word? What words?
Darkness.
Darkness, okay.
Covered.
Covered? What was it? Covered, okay. Laziness.
Depression,
okay.
False ego.
Anything else? Yeah.
Pride,
interesting, okay. Yeah, and that's also a mode of passion as well. So one word I was thinking of is bewilderment, being bewildered, being confused, being covered over. That's a good one. And I was, yeah, sure.
I was thinking of ignorance, literally being ignorant or clueless.
Yeah.
I was thinking, it's not, yeah, I guess somewhat.
There's a connection for sure, yeah.
Holy, totally.
Yeah. Ignorant, ignoring certain facts.
In this case, it was cruel.
Cruel, yeah. Yeah. Harshness, yes. So almost like a disconnection from compassion. Ignorance can make us very, it can cut us off from those qualities of the mode of goodness. And one of the qualities of the mode of goodness is compassion and equanimity and soberness and tolerance and all those things that you would think, okay, the guru would look, let me fully understand the situation here before, jumping in and cursing. That I get that sense too. And again, there's missing details to the story, but I get the sense that the guru didn't, there wasn't much conversation about like, hey, what happened? Can you describe the situation? It was just like, oh my gosh, you killed a cow. That's kind of it seems like that because of how quickly he cursed his disciple. So this word bewilderment, the thing that's the highest in the spiritual world is often the lowest here. The perverted reflection, right? The perverted reflection of bewilderment is what we see in the material world. And what I mean by that is Krishna has this covering energy, this illusory energy. And in the spiritual world, it's called what? Yoga Maya, right? Krishna's covering potency. So that which bewilders us, and in a beautiful, loving way, that it bewilders everyone there in the sense of allowing the residents of Vrindavan to forget that Krishna's God and completely get absorbed in their role with Krishna as a mother or as a friend and so on. And then the perverted reflection or the bewilderment, the most extreme of that is forgetting that we are eternal spirit souls, that ignorance, and that's created by Mahamaya, the Maya, the energy of Krishna that's in this world. So in either case, there is a sort of, the jiva is very tiny, and either case is not as powerful as Krishna's energy, right? So when we're in this material world, we are taken over by Krishna's energy, and we're completely ignorant of what our real self is. We become in that mode of ignorance, that covered, all those words that you said, right? There's another story coming up that this reminds me of, and it's coming up, I think, on Thursday. Another example of a sage who was acting under a mode, and then the person that he cursed taking it with such grace. Do you know? You know. Okay. Anyone else know? So when you think about modes of nature, if you think about the mode of passion, what do you think about? What's the first thing that comes to mind? Think of mode of passion. Or one of them. Lust. Okay. What else? What other emotion comes up? What's a strong emotion of the mode of passion? Anger. Yes. So which sage, can you think of a sage that had a lot of anger? Durvasa. Yeah. So you're going to hear another story, another pastime of Durvasa Muni and Ambarish. And it's very similar. You'll see the parallels with how Ambarish responds to that injustice, quote unquote injustice. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, Apichet sudaracharo, bhajate mama nanyabhag, sadur eva samantavya samyag vyavasito hisa. And the translation is, even if one commits the most abominable action, if he's engaged in devotional service, he's to be considered saintly because he's properly situated in his determination. So this would have been, if Vasishtha had, you know, quoted from this, it would have been more appropriate, because this servant, or this follower, this family member, this disciple, you know, family disciple, he was actually acting very saintly, and he just made a mistake. So Prabhupada says, as far as possible, devotee is very cautious, so he doesn't do anything that could disrupt the wholesome condition. He knows that perfection in his activities depends on his progress. Sometimes, however, it may be seen that a person in Krishna consciousness commits some act which may be taken as most abominable socially or politically, but such a temporary fall down doesn't disqualify him. Yeah, so that's how we understand this story, and that's how we understand that this. And that's why I think when you mentioned that he didn't get caught up in, and maybe he did feel some, of course he obviously felt remorse for killing a cow, but he knew his intention was there. Like it's different if you commit something knowingly as opposed to mistake, right? Two very different things. So in our life, we can think about, how do we respond to injustice? Or being treated like someone doesn't really understand us and they're responding to us in that way, right? It's something we can reflect on. And then the other thing I wanted to mention, and it ties in with yesterday's class. Yesterday's class was so great. Kalakanta Prabhu made some really wonderful points. I was thinking how one way that ignorance is present in our experience is when we look at other people as bodies and not souls. That's one way, that's actually a covering, that's an illusion, and that's us acting out of ignorance. So when I'm getting caught up in someone's exterior, yesterday we were talking about gender, right, and so on. If I'm getting lost in that, the mask or the wrappings around the soul, what they look like, how they are, then that's, I'm acting in ignorance. And there was a comment near the end, and I couldn't catch who said it, so maybe someone can share who said this, but there's a really great comment at the end of that class about we don't necessarily have to understand what someone's going through to be able to be empathic. Does someone remember who said that? Kevin. Okay. Yeah, that was a really, really thoughtful comment, and I wanted to just like amplify it because it was so, so profound that we don't have to be going through the exact same experience as another person to be able to offer them empathy and acceptance. And you had mentioned that, like, you can find something in what they are feeling that you can relate to, for example, loneliness or fear of rejection and so on, these common human experiences. And if we as devotees, as Vaishnavas, can learn to do that, then we can create a culture of acceptance and love that everyone is hankering for. So we don't have to necessarily, like if someone has has a disability or a condition or a family history that we don't relate to, that's okay. We don't have to exactly match up on everything. But if we can understand that they also have a need for acceptance and for understanding, or that they also struggle with loneliness and those things, then we can make them feel less alone and welcome them into that community. And then at the same time, these are just some kind of thoughts that I had over yesterday's class that I was thinking in the context of seeing each other as souls and not the body, right? To tie it in with today, like not being in the mode of ignorance where we get consumed in someone's identity, material identity, and how to do that as a community so that we can really create that culture. And so on the one hand, we can offer this acceptance of, yes, I also understand what that's like when someone's, you know, I don't always feel like I'm in my right place, or I also have felt out of place, and really, that must be really hard, that kind of thing. And at the same time, also trying our best to understand their experience. So that's one other point I wanted to make, that we try our best to also, like yesterday, it was so refreshing. Nikhil Kantapuru was just talking about these issues so openly and so with so much acceptance and love, right? And to learn how to speak about them with the right terminology so that people feel included and not, you know, like that. It's also part of our job in this material world, is to learn about the people that we're in right now, the world we're in right now, the who's around us, and as much as possible, even if we don't understand it, even if we're confused and all that, but to, like, as much as possible, be able to speak about these things. And so I was thinking about listening when we listen to someone, or how we respond to someone when they share about themselves. And sometimes we can, it's really tricky with our amazing philosophy we have in Krishna consciousness. It's like this double, you know, this fine line that we have to walk, where we have this incredible philosophy, you're not the body. And yet someone might be going through something that's directly impacting they're going through a really difficult time because of the body they're in and the mind they have and so on. Right. So we can't just spiritual bypass that, because sometimes people are able to jump ahead, like this great devotee Prashadra, right? He was able to kind of go, hey, drop all of that and just go right to the essence, which is Krishna. But most of the time, for most of us, we need to get comfortable in the material world in order to practice Krishna consciousness, right? So we want to make sure that we're sharing the philosophy not to make them feel uncomfortable, that, oh, you're not the body, so like, don't talk about it. Like, this is not just, you know, I know what I was going to say. Sometimes I might say, oh, you're not the body anyway. And the motivation might be, oh, I hope you stop talking about this because this is making you really uncomfortable. So you're just not the body. Like, let's just not talk about this subject, right? So that's one way that spiritual philosophy can be used as a way to protect my own discomfort. Like, oh, protect me from something I'm not comfortable talking about. On the reverse, it would be, let me sit with this discomfort that's coming up. Someone's telling me something that I don't know, I don't understand, I'm uncomfortable. Yes, the philosophy is there, but maybe what they need in order to understand the philosophy better is some compassion and understanding of the material condition as well. So not just jumping over them, oh, you're not the body. First, let me hear you. What is that like? And what I found the most helpful in my life is when, and probably similar for you, is when someone just says, wow, that sounds difficult. And that's it. Not any kind of solution, not anything. Just like, wow, that's very challenging. That must be hard. Or I hear you. That's thanks for sharing. And just like that, just holding that. And it doesn't take much. So it's not like we have to, with these issues that we don't understand or don't relate to, we don't have to have the solution or know like how to directly answer or talk to someone, but just a few words of understanding is all it takes. So I wanted to kind of add that on to yesterday's class, and yeah, because it was such a great topic. And I'd like to open up if anyone has any. Yes, Kevin.
Here we go. Thank you for class. One thing on this last topic you were sharing about someone sharing their heart, opening their heart with you. I was at the Bhakti Center not long ago, and this one Prabhu who deals with grieving, and he's like a minister, a chaplain or so.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying that people come to us to share their hearts, and we're very quick to say the phrase, "I'm sorry," like right when we hear what they're saying. But he expressed that by saying that, we cut off everything that they're about to give us,
mm-hmm.
because we've already concluded with, "I'm sorry," like very early. But like you said, you know, tell me more, or yeah, this is difficult. You know, like it allows them to continue to let out whatever's in their heart. But that phrase, "Oh, I'm so sorry," oh, like yeah, I'm sorry about that, just like really cuts them off and doesn't allow them to share, like blocks the surface.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Sometimes it just takes a few moments of silence before jumping in to allow, I mean, not a few moments, maybe more, but to give that person ample space and time to share everything before we jump in with something like that. It's very final. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Tough luck, you know, sounds like tough luck. Yeah. Any other thoughts on that or anything? Christina.
I'm going to sing my comment. This is the chorus to a song I really like.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to be related to relate. We don't need to share genes or surname. You are my chosen family. So what if we don't look the same? We've been going through the same pain, yeah. You are my chosen family. That's a Chosen Family by Rina Sawayama.
Very appropriate. Beautiful. Any other thoughts or comments? Oh, yes, Lo.
Hello. Okay, so I had to leave yesterday's class early because I had an 8:30 a.m. stats class, which was terrible. But I listened to Kalakanta Prabhu's class, and I'm very grateful for having such like an open-minded, accepting perspective, because I don't identify with male or female, and like that's not a choice that I really have. It's just like how I feel. And a lot of people like don't understand that or are confused by that or judgmental towards me because of that. But I'm really grateful that like there's scriptural evidence of like how to deal with not understanding and like how we should go about the process of getting to know someone better and being supportive. That's all I have to say.
Thank you so much, Lo. And I'm so grateful there's a space where you feel, you know, encouraged in your spiritual life. This is something over the years, I think it's probably the thing that causes the most pain for me is when I see, and I've seen examples and I've heard many people, this particular topic for, you know, for academic and personal reasons, I've done a lot of research on this topic of gender studies and so on. And just across my lifetime, I've seen devotees who have left, sincere souls who have left the movement because of the judgment of other devotees. And it's just the most painful thing, the most heartbreaking thing, because like Kalakanta Prabhu said yesterday, the whole purpose of Krishna consciousness is to finally offer a space where everyone, regardless of identity, can come together and serve Krishna. And so to think that someone might come to the shelter of Krishna finally after so long, and then to be, and it's still happening in some countries. I just heard of another case anyway, in South America. It's just like, yeah, it's just something we have to, in our own hearts, we have to really work on that so that we can continue to make, even as individuals, each one of us can have that mood of acceptance and love, then we can create a culture like that. of how can I keep this soul around so that they can be of service? What can I do to facilitate their service? And instead of pushing them out because of prejudice and judgment, which is so ironic, right? Because our whole philosophy is that everyone's a part of Krishna and we're not the body, we're spirit souls, and everyone should be allowed to serve Krishna. So I get really, I feel some pain around that subject. I know there was this, there was one devotee who was, anyway, I won't get into details so much, but just there was one devotee when I was growing up who was transgender, and years later I asked about her, like what had happened. And I heard that like in the community, she started at a certain point for many years, she was doing amazing service and she was such a special soul. I really liked her. And then years later, more recently I asked like whatever happened to that devotee, and then I found out that some devotees had started to make her feel really bad about being trans, and like, and had basically she didn't feel comfortable anymore coming around, so she left. And like, that's the greatest loss of all, right? It's the most, I think what we this is the most sad thing of all, is to think that we as devotees could push someone, a sincere soul, away. It's something to, hopefully none of us will do that. And I think that we here at Krishna House do the opposite, which is bringing everyone closer to Krishna. So yeah, that was my little tirade, but I hope that came out okay. Okay, so any other last points or thoughts on that? Prabhupada Priya.
You know, we're not living in an ideal world. So although Krishna House is a nice little happy, inclusive microcosm, we will come in contact with people who will judge us and misjudge us, and we will be victims of injustice. It's just the way the world is. It's Kali Yuga. It's an ocean of faults.
Yeah.
And so it's important to keep this in mind, that when we are victims of injustice, to take it in the right spirit,
mm-hmm.
that we don't have to go away because some ignorant person misjudged us.
Yeah.
Like we can choose, we can't control the way people treat us, but we can control the way we respond to it. So we have options.
Yeah.
And we can choose the path that Prishudra chose, and to use it as an impetus to become more Krishna conscious, to show them that I'm not going to be put down by this. I'm going to go forward.
Yes, I think that's really important. It's a two-way street. One is the responsibility of the other people, how they act towards us. And then the other is, how am I going to take this? And what am I going to do with it? And how am I going to continue being of service and as much as possible staying in the association of devotees? But when a devotee leaves, I think it's helpful if we think about what could we have done better. I think it's always a helpful attitude. Like, what could we have done better to keep that soul around? But yes, at the end of the day, we have the soul, the person also has to navigate that and work through that as well. So that's a really good point. Thank you. All right. Looks like breakfast is here. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.